The next case on the docket is Frank Joseph Campos v. State. Case number 76309.
Navid Afshar, you're ready to go.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Navid Afshar, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Frank Campos. In Nevada, district courts enjoy broad discretion when it comes to sentencing. This court reviews that for an abuse of discretion. However, it's difficult to have meaningful appellate review of that sentence without the district court articulating their reasons as to why they impose that sentence on the record. This court has the authority, the judicial authority, to impose such a requirement. It's not the legislature, it's this court, and respectfully, this court should do so. Now, to the first point as to whether this court has the authority, we look to Campbell v. State in 1998, a misdemeanor case where this court declined to impose such a requirement. In declining to do so, it examined the Colorado Supreme Court case Watkins, which does require it, finding that Watkins was an opposite because that was a felony case. It also declined to impose Brown because Brown only recommended it. And lastly, this court stated that such action is best left to the legislature. However, fast forwarding it to Mendoza-Lobos in 2009, there's a contradiction there with Mendoza-Lobos. Mendoza-Lobos dealt with the felony as the case here and as the Colorado Supreme Court case in Watkins. Now, this court noted in Mendoza-Lobos, ironically, the state's position then during oral argument was that the legislature had encroached on the judicial authority when it passed 193.165 subsection 1 by requiring that the district court judge consider certain enumerated factors when imposing the deadly weapon enhancement, and that they state on the record that they had considered those factors. This court agreed with the state of Nevada that the legislature had encroached on its authority, but only to the extent that the legislature had dictated what the judges could or could not say on the record during pronouncement of sentence. This court recognized that to be a separation of powers violation. That's contradictory to Campbell. Now, in the state's response brief, with respect to the state, there's a difference of opinion as to what Mendoza-Lobos stands for in this regard. The state indicates, or seems to indicate, that essentially the legislature considers public policy, which part of it, with that statute, was prison overcrowding and long sentences, and then passes a bill which basically serves as a recommendation to this court that this court may adopt. But the state seems to note in their response that it's the legislature's job to consider public policy, not this court's. However, my reading of Mendoza-Lobos is that this court was very clear. It was a separation of powers violation. And while the legislature had committed a separation of powers violation, this court approved of what it had done, and that this court ordered the district courts to follow, to comply with 193.165. But this court went further and noted, in no way are we acquiescing any of this authority to the legislature because it's not implicated within the legislature's authority. So, if Mendoza-Lobos stands for the proposition that it's a separation of powers violation, which the state even acknowledges in the response brief, for the legislature to dictate what the sentencing court may or may not say during pronouncement of sentence, then how does Campbell stand for the proposition that this is entirely left to the legislature to decide? It does not. And therefore, under Mendoza, this court does have the jurisdiction. There's a contradiction between the two, and I think Mendoza controls because it's more applicable to felony cases, and because this court did a thorough constitutional analysis in Mendoza, which was not present in Campbell. So this court has the jurisdiction to do so. So respectfully, it should. Now, the state noted that they were puzzled that why we had cited to all these cases where other cases where this court has imposed such a requirement. But it's not a puzzle, because even in Mendoza in the dissent noted that there was a recent trend based on Knipes v. State, which came out a year prior to Mendoza, that that this court was requiring district courts to impose more factual findings.
Mr. Asher?
Yes.
Back to the actual sentencing. How is there plain error on this record? Because there was no objection, so the court didn't specifically say, hey, de factor one, I find de factor two. So that, whether there's good practice or not, how can we look at this record and say there's plain error?
Well, Your Honor, one thing I would like to address is the plain error argument. I acknowledge that we did not object, but I would also note that there's no legal requirement in Nevada for judges to state anything.
Okay, but it's still plain error. So how do we look at that and say there was a miscarriage of justice for what's arguably a first-degree murder?
Well, I think the issue that we're having here is if we look at this record here, the judge is saying, you know, I consider the mitigation. You know, I looked at it, there's mitigation, and the judge says, and I noticed he didn't get first degree, he got second degree. But that doesn't explain why the judge imposed the sentence that they did in light of the mitigation. Just saying that, that he could have gotten first degree. The point is, if you know, under Wilson, if the judge is to consider all the, you know, the mitigation, the judge would consider the mitigation and then give us a why. And the why would be, hey, there are certain facts here in this case that, despite the mitigation, I feel the sentence is appropriate. And the judge here imposed the maximum aggregate sentence, and there was considerable mitigation. And in fairness to the judge here, as you point out, there's no standard in Nevada, so the judge just happened to say something. But if there was a standard, the judge would have then, could have then considered the mitigation and said, in spite of this, this is why I'm opposing the sentence. But I don't think making a cursory reference to, well, you could have gotten first degree murder.
Yeah, but he said more than that. He said you have no, this is bizarre, you have no criminal history. Mm. You know, it seems like on these facts, you've been given substantial consideration. You know, given the facts, he's addressed the facts. He certainly acknowledges in the sentencing transcript that he's paid attention to what's in the PSI. They had a Stockmeyer discussion. So the court has all the information. Help me.
I would just say, yes, that is true. The court did get all the information, and the court acknowledged that it got all the information. But again, and this is the larger issue we're going for, is why we want a rule imposed that they articulate it in line with the other our sister states that have either strongly recommended or required it, because simply saying you could have gotten first-degree murder doesn't say, yeah, I consider the mitigation. And we're not asking for a line-by-line breakdown of, okay, you were sober or you had an alcohol problem, no prior criminal history other than a misdemeanor from 1984, shoplifting, and that's why. But if the court had said, consider the mitigation, because the mitigation was presented by defense counsel, not just in the PSI, but expressly provided by defense counsel at the time of the sentencing hearing. And just said, I understand that, but you could have gotten first-degree murder, here's a sentence. Instead of, because of this, because of the facts, because of the victim speakers, something that would allow us. And it goes to a broader point, Your Honor, because there are two reasons why I think it's good policy. Because this court has a jurisdiction. One thing I'd like to point out first is, I know it's important to focus on just this case, but because this is an issue of statewide public importance, and we are asking for a general rule to be imposed, many times this court sees cases where the judges say nothing and just impose a sentence. So looking at that, looking at the Colorado Supreme Court case, which I would argue is applicable here, it wasn't applicable in Campbell because that dealt with misdemeanor, it is applicable here. The Colorado Supreme Court, citing to the ABA standards on appellate review for sentencing, noted that it is beneficial during sentencing of felony.
So let's carry this one step further.
Yes.
Both the ABA standards for criminal justice, as well as the Amjur criminal law, section 717, dealing with the reasons or the rationale for requiring the expression by the sentencing judge of the factors, both mitigating and aggravating at sentencing is to afford appellate review. In our state, we have essentially conducted very little appellate review, provided that the sentence is within the statutory framework and is not influenced by impalpable evidence. And that has been the standard, for as long as I think I've practiced, and certainly as long as I've been a judge. So if the underlying reason for requiring the mitigation and expression of mitigation and aggravating circumstances is different than what our appellate review jurisprudence currently is, why should we require that? I get your point that the defendant would like to know why I'm spending a longer sentence than a shorter sentence, but the policy reasons afforded in the treatise and in the standards of the ABA and the American jurisprudence second edition points to a different policy purpose, appellate review. We currently don't do that here.
Your Honor, that's an excellent point. We do have appellate review. The district court judges have a broad discretion, but not universal discretion. There are two primary ways in the state that a sentence may be challenged. Under Slips v. State, if it's, the statute is unconstitutional, or if it shocks the conscience. And I would agree, in that scenario, it's not necessary for the district court judge to articulate any sentences on the record. We could just look at the record to determine that. However, for the other part, whether the defendant was prejudiced based on the consideration of highly impalpable or suspect evidence, yes, we could look at the PMP report. We could look at, for example, records introduced during the penalty phase of a capital trial when they were juvenile. But what better way than to have the district court judge actually indicate what they considered when they imposed that sentence? District court judges may make a good faith mistake like anyone else. And in fact, the Colorado Supreme Court noted that in citing the ABA. I know it's for a different policy, but they said that having them articulate the reasons on the record is an invaluable tool to appellate review, but more importantly, it will minimize the risk that the judge may rely on misinformation or a mistake of fact. And even in the other case that we cited, for example, in Reed of United States, U.S. Supreme Court case, although that relied on a federal statute, which isn't applicable here because under Mendoza-Lobos, I'm arguing we don't need that here in Nevada, but the U.S. Supreme Court noted the benefits of doing it. It creates more trust, more public confidence in the verdict. And the reason that we brought up these other cases is that, I mean, we're dealing with cases where there are Fourth Amendment implications, Sixth Amendment implications, even in civil cases, this court is requiring more information, findings of fact, explanation. We're talking about perhaps the most critical stage of the process when the defendant's liberty is at stake.
Let me just back you up. So
yes.
Does this sentence on its face shock the conscience?
On its face, I think it's excessive. I don't know if I would say it shocks the conscience necessarily.
So it's you think it's excessive? It's certainly not excessive for the statute. It's within the statutory
guidelines.
Correct.
Within the statutory
guidelines. You're saying on these facts, it shocks the conscience. Because there's two things. Shocks the conscience or evidence. So I'm going to take them one at a time. Are you saying this sentence shocks the conscience?
It doesn't shock the conscience necessarily, but it is excessive.
And what improper evidence are you suggesting the court relied upon in instead of giving a one bottom, giving an eight bottom? We're talking about 7 years difference to the parole board. That why we're here. So what evidence do you suspect that the court relied upon that was improper that caused the court to give the higher end of the deadly weapon enhancement?
None that I know of, but that's the problem. Because the district court isn't required to even give a brief explanation.
Well, they did give a brief explanation. Your argument is it's too brief.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not even that it was too brief. It lacked the substance for us to adequately consider what the court said. We're not asking for a lengthy record, as the U.S. Supreme Court noted in Rita, as in the Colorado Supreme Court noted. Just a brief explanation. We're not asking for findings of fact.
Well, there's another way to demonstrate that the court relied on impalpable evidence, mm-hmm. and that's by looking at the hearing itself. Mm-hmm. So what evidence was introduced at the sentencing hearing that you consider to be impalpable?
There was nothing that I can say that was presented to the judge that would be...
So how can we conclude that the judge, even though there were, it was kind of a conclusory sentence, relied on impalpable evidence? I mean, what would we expect the judge in this case to have said or done?
Your Honor,
based on the record that's before the judge.
Your Honor, I guess the broader point is that we don't know unless the judge indicates their thoughts. And that's my whole point. And honestly, just addressing this, seeing as how there's so much from our sister states from the Supreme Court about the policy and how this court is adopting in other areas, I don't understand why we wouldn't do it. The only plausible argument I could see would be judicial economy. But again, we're only asking for a brief few sentences from the court as to why they did. And, you know, one thing that the state is currently examining is sentencing disparities. I think it would help with sentencing disparities to know why judges impose the sentence that they do. And we're not getting that now. So even with judicial economy, I think
that may be the case. Yeah. But I think, in fairness to the district courts, defense counsels should either object or request these findings so that a district court judge has an opportunity to make a record that then perhaps we'd have a case that we could assess. It's very difficult to do this on plain air. I think you would agree with that.
Yes, Your Honor. But I think it's such an issue of statewide public importance that's necessary. And I would just add that it is difficult, but if they did object, the court would probably say, hey, under Campbell, which I submit today, doesn't stand for that proposition. I don't have to do anything.
Well, but then we'd have the legal issues squared up. Are we operating under Campbell or are we operating under Mendoza in connection with the separation of powers issue?
Right.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Pesci.
Giancarlo Pesci on behalf of the respondent. If I could start, Justice Stiglitz, with your question. What shocks the conscience? The facts. The facts shock the conscience. This appellant took a shotgun and blew a woman's head off. And as the court indicated in giving the rendition of the sentence, she took into consideration the very heinous nature of the actual crime. The appellant had every opportunity to explain all the mitigation, was given another opportunity to say what it is that they wanted to present, was not prohibited in any way, shape, or form. So under the jurisprudence as it exists, it's not highly impalpable or suspect, and doesn't shock the conscience. And if we could pivot to Campbell, because I'm hearing that Campbell is the reason why we should have the authority, but I think we should look at Campbell and say to ourselves this. When Campbell, which by the way said, you shouldn't look over the shoulders of the sentencing judge, when Campbell was decided, it pointed to the case out of Colorado. Well, let's look at the case out of Colorado, People v. Watkins. And I think the court in Campbell narrowed themselves too much by saying it's just the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor. Really, the difference is Campbell has a statute. Therein lies the difference. In the state of Nevada, there is no such statute. The people of the state of Colorado have seen fit through the legislative process to create the very thing they're asking for right now. That's why looking to this case and to try to utilize it as a means to create that opportunity for you is inappropriate, because the legislature has the job of creating that through public policy, through hearings, through votes. And think about it. If you move away from Campbell and you move on to Mendoza-Lopez...
Well, that may be. Are you arguing, Mr. Pesci, that this court, or at least an en banc court of the Supreme Court, wouldn't have the inherent authority to, in a decision, appropriately briefed and addressed through the facts, to lay out a requirement that district judges state factors at sentencing?
I think there's been nothing presented to your honors to change the current jurisprudence, which says currently defer to the legislature. That's the jurisprudence. That's what this case came up with, this court came up with in Campbell and Pittman. Justice Silver, you were involved in Pittman. That echoed Campbell, which says the legislature is the one that makes this decision. So whether you may or may not have the inherent power, Justice Horsley, what I would say is it should go through the legislative process. And think about it, if we turn to the legislative process and specifically as to Mendoza,
certainly in other cases, in civil cases, we require attorneys or appellants to have shown that the district court goes through making findings on why attorney's fees are proper in any certain case, and they have to state on the record, because we don't have a good appellate review without those findings. That's judicially created. We know that Justice Pickering has a landmark case involving making findings on the record regarding child custody, and certainly you're not suggesting that this court doesn't have that authority under the right circumstances to inherit this inherent authority that when it comes to criminal law and sentencing, that we could, in fact, pronounce a rule that makes the district court make some kind of findings on the record regarding their sentencing.
What I'm saying is there's not a reason to make you make that decision. There's not a reason to reverse your own jurisprudence. There isn't a basis to undo stare decisis. What is it? You've been told it'll be helpful for the review. You've been told it's going to be quick. Judicial economy is the argument saying against it, right? But they're saying it's just going to be 15 minutes. Seriously? It's going to be way more than 15 minutes. If we have the findings on every single one of these, and I mean this respectfully, I'm not trying to be flippant. Just think back to being a district court judge and as a sentencing officer. You're never going to hear no rec from the state again. You're never going to hear submitted from the state again. Because if what you're asking for, or they're asking for, is adopted and created, the state is now burdened with the responsibility of creating a record to juxtapose against the mitigation. It'll be like a death penalty sentence. You just brought that up a moment ago. If I do what we did in this case, and we make our recommendation, and we don't say anything more about the defendant, and then the mitigation is brought forth, and there's tons and tons of mitigation, a sentence is imposed, and then what is being asked of you is done, you get to sit in review of the district court. In order to have that full record, we're talking about let them have the full record so that the judge makes a full record. The state is going to make the full record, too. We're going to tell you everything he's done wrong in his entire life, because we're going to have to counterbalance what the mitigation is. We don't do that in every case because we know there's discretion with the court, that the court has the discretion to make a finding. And what's interesting, talking about the authority, when we turn to Mendoza-Lopez, the decision rested in part on the legislative history. The court articulated and pointed to the legislative history. So I went to it. I went to the legislative history of that case and the statutes associated with it. And while there is discussion about making findings, there's also discussions about a deadly weapon being an actual deadly weapon. Many of the senators are talking about, well, it shouldn't be a pin, or it shouldn't be something that's really not a deadly weapon. There was concern that the deadly weapon, the equal and consecutive, the doubling, was based on that. It wasn't just about making findings. Now, what's interesting, as you look through the legislative history of that statute, the findings portion was in and then out. It didn't make the cut. You can look at it right now. You can pull it up. You can see the first draft doesn't say anything about that. Later drafts, it has it in there. The final draft, it's gone. The legislature has spoken. They made their decision, and they cut it out. They didn't utilize it. And think about it. When we look at this particular case, and you say to yourself, the judicial economy that will be involved, how will it be more judicially economic for this court to review every single sentence? Because every defendant is going to appeal every sentencing. They have that right already. If it shocks the conscience or it's based on highly suspect or impalpable, they have that. But now it's going to be...
You can't put that into a plea agreement?
I'm sorry, which
one? You certainly could put something in a plea agreement, too, regarding sentencing appeals. I mean, you already put it into a plea agreement regarding the plea itself. There's all kinds of things that you could put in the plea agreement. So, I mean, if you step away from this judicial economy, what about just the fact that maybe the public or anybody in the courtroom or even victims have a right to know? I mean, if you turn it around, it's not just the harsh, you know, why didn't they look at the mitigating factors? How many times have you seen a district court and maybe it's a horrific, what you believe to be horrific crime, and the judge gives probation and there's nothing that's said with that? And you think, what about all the aggravating factors that it seems like the judge missed?
Right.
Isn't public policy, not just for appellate purposes, but maybe to require the judges to say why they gave a sentence for everyone in the courtroom?
So that brings up a great point, Justice. Thank you. It's a double-edged sword, right? Because you're saying how even the state could be disappointed with the actual enhancing sentencing. Agreed. So let's assume for the sake of argument that they went really low, the district court judge. And then this one is Judge Adair. She went with the maximum, right?
It was Judge Togliatti, I think.
No, it was Judge Adair. The case when the sentencing actually occurred was in front of Judge Adair. So if we go with that rationale, right, there is no recourse for the state. If the judge went with 24 years on that weapon enhancement and this mechanism for appeal occurred, it can't go higher. The rule of lenity, it has to go lower or stand pat. It can't go higher. So ask yourself, could a district court judge think in the back of her mind or his mind, yeah, I'm going to go high because with this new mechanism that looks over my shoulder and says that really wasn't good enough or that wasn't appropriate, it's going to go down. It's not going to go up. It can't go up. The law prohibits it from going up. So you might incentivize district court judges to go higher. That could be an unintended consequence that could be very bad for appellants. And so really, the other question I ask is this, respectfully, what puts the appellate court or the Supreme Court of Nevada in a better position to say what the appropriate sentence is? Why does the appellate court have better eyes on the victim impact or better eyes on the defendant? What makes this body better able to determine whether it's an appropriate sentence? So I mean, really, honestly, that's my question that I turn back is, how is it that that is better, or you're in a better situation to be able to, you have the record, that's true, right? But you don't see everything that comes on during trial. You don't see the victim impact. You can read it. It's a totally different thing to see it, right? Or the mitigation. It's a cold transcript. And so I don't know that an appellate court has a better position to be able to do that. Plus, on top of that, what's going to happen? Is there going to be like an algorithm that's produced to say on deadly weapon enhancements on a one-time felon, the 24 should be the top, or if it's someone with a prior felony that was violent, it's going to go up to 36 months? Or do we look at the specific facts of this case where he took a shotgun and he blew a woman's head off and say, under those facts that are reviewable by this court, that are put forth in the pre-sentence investigation, which is in the record, does that shock the conscience? Was it based on highly suspect or impalpable evidence? The state's position is to the contrary. There's been no reason put forth to undo the jurisprudence. We ask that you stay with your prior decisions in Campbell and Pittman. Thank you.
You have adequate time left over, Mr. Pesci. I think the beep went off at the five-minute mark, but do you wish to submit?
Yes, unless there are further questions, I think I've addressed the issues that I had concerns with. I mean, there's a record specifically what Judge Adair took into consideration. I think that's really important because when you look at Campbell, I'm sorry, at Mendoza-Lopez, this court found that the error was harmless. Under the plain error, it was harmless because it's really difficult for a district court to do what's being asked, right? Because let's say that you tell them that they need to do this. What are they going to say? I made a finding because he's really young, or I made a finding because he has no prior criminal history. He did actually. He had a felony that was reduced to a misdemeanor. It's not like he didn't have anything. It was very, very minimal. What then becomes the appellate review of that? Like, you said you found it because of this, but that's egregious, it's too much, or it's too little, and keep in the back of your mind, it can never go higher. So district court judges are going to be thinking about that when they make their decision. Thank you.